The WLEW, News and Public Affairs Department, now presents What Do You Think? Here's your host, Craig Routson, with today's topic.
Good morning. Our guest today in the studio is Dr. Brandon Fernandez. Actually, he's on the phone. He's a doctor of veterinary medicine at the Bad Axe Animal Small Animal Clinic, and we are going to be talking about winter animals and things you need to know to keep your animals of all sizes safe. I'd like to thank you for being with us today, Doctor.
Well, thank you for having me.
I guess the first thing I'd ask is, what type of animals do you basically specialize in over there?
I wouldn't say exactly I specialize in any particular type of animal. I see all types: cats, dogs, horses, cattle, goats, sheep, sort of the whole gambit.
Is it difficult to do so many different animals, because each of them seem to have their own little quirks?
They do, but there's a lot of common things among them, and then really the trick is to learn the differences and how that affects their health. So it's really a comparative medicine type of field, where we kind of look at all animals and then learn the quirks of each one.
Now you're in an area where you deal with all different size animals. In the city, you would probably be more pets and stuff, but here we have farm animals and such. So you gotta know how to handle them.
Yes, that's something that that comes in very handy. You know, knowing how to move cattle or knowing how to approach a horse who may not be familiar with you and may be a little bit nervous having a stranger around.
And may not be feeling well at the time.
Yes.
And I know I'm grumpy when I'm sick.
I think we can all relate to that.
And so you have to know what to do and how to approach them, but how do you have to rely on the owners a lot as to whether they tell you the horse is really skittish or he likes people, he's just not feeling good? I mean, that can run ways too.
We actually rely on the owner for a lot of things. The owner's sort of the intermediary between us and the animal, because they don't know who we are. We're a stranger. A lot of times we smell funny, like medicine or other animals. So we always like to approach after the owner or ask the owner how the temperament is. And we also rely on the owner to give us a lot of information about how their pet's feeling. They can't tell us how they feel, whether it be a pet or a farm animal. But the owner's with that animal every day, and they can give us a lot of information that's very helpful in trying to determine what's wrong.
Is there like a whole course when you go to veterinary school to learn how to handle animals? I mean, dogs in particular, the same breed, one can be the friendliest thing you'd ever want to meet, and the other can be a little skittish and snarly.
There is, in fact. There's an animal handling course that we all take, and it's a couple times a week mixed in with all our other courses, and it's actually one of the more enjoyable courses early on in the curriculum, because we get to get out and do things hands-on with animals. But we go to different parts of the small animal clinic and different parts of the farms. In my case, I went to MSU. So I went to the different MSU farms and learned how to approach and how to handle all the different species.
Is your confidence in being able to do this a factor? I know I see these TV shows like The Dog Whisperer, where you have to let the animal know that you are the leader. Is that something that you kind of have to show, that you know what you're doing and they just go along?
It is in some situations. Dogs that are not really sure about you and are, possibly a little standoffish, or may even be protective of the owner as they're in a environment that they're not familiar with and they may perceive as threatening, a lot of times they just want to protect their owner. So, taking the leash and approaching the dog confidently will sometimes, surprise them enough that by the time they have decided whether or not they feel that you're a threat, you're petting them and have shown yourself not to be. But it's a case-by-case basis, certainly.
Is it kind of counterintuitive to what people might think, the bigger dogs are the bigger danger, or do the little ones actually be the ones that snap more?
Well, there are a lot of little dogs that tend to get away with more due to their size. So we do deal with some aggression in little dogs, and I would say on the average probably more so than we do in big dogs. But a large aggressive dog certainly presents more of a danger to myself, my staff, and the owners if they're in a situation where they feel threatened or become aggressive.
What about cats? When I take mine in, all of the cats I've had, every time I take them in, they just seem like they're so scared they aren't doing anything, and you guys seem to handle them and give them shots and do all this stuff, and they just kind of go with the flow.
It all depends on the cat. Some of them think it's a great adventure, and they want to look around the room and explore, look out the windows, and greet me and my staff. And others are just like you described, where they're so afraid of the situation that they just kind of freeze up and go along with what we're doing. And some are quite aggressive, and they don't want to be there, and they don't want to be messed with by you, and they'll let you know that. It's just as varying as you would see with dogs, I would say.
Well, you deal with the animals all the time. What is the thing people most often do wrong? Is it not getting them checked regularly, the vaccinations, the spaying or neutering? What are the most important things people need to know with their animals?
There's a lot of different things we can talk about in particulars, but I would say the best thing to do to keep your pet healthy is preventative health. So coming in for the annual checkups and vaccines, new recommendations, because you know the old adage of a dog's year being 7 human years, it doesn't quite work out that way, but it's similar to that. And because of that, if we bring our pets in once a year, it would be like us going to the doctor and getting checked out once every 7 years. So we actually recommend to stay on top of things every 6 months and staying up with their vaccines and their regular health checks. And then, you know, at the first sign of trouble, that's usually the best time to bring a pet in to see if we can help. A lot of times we can catch a disease early in the process where we can intervene and make the pet a lot better or help slow the progression of the disease a lot more than we can further down the road.
Are animals that generally spend a lot more time outside more susceptible to problems than indoor?
Not necessarily. Cats definitely have more dangers that they can encounter outdoors, and there's been studies that have shown that cats that go indoors and outdoors tend not to live as long as indoor-only cats, but there are some health problems that indoor-only cats are more prone to just because they don't have as much exercise and things to do by going outside. So it doesn't quite turn out that way. It really depends on how much interaction that those animals have with their owners, and really how good the owners are at keeping an eye on making sure their pets are healthy, I think, as opposed to indoors or outdoors.
What about diet? Sometimes people think they're doing them favors with table scraps, and you know, because they really like them, but is that really a no-no?
It is in a lot of cases. You know, we see a lot of obesity in our pets, and the obesity can lead to any number of health problems, heart disease, organ disease, diabetes. So because of that obesity issue, sometimes there's the table scraps can add to that in a very real way. And in some breeds and some animals, some table scraps can be really bad. Cats and dogs are both kind of susceptible to toxicities with onions and garlic and things like that, but cats are a lot more susceptible to it. So feeding a dog a piece of seasoned meat may not be that bad, but feeding your cat a piece of seasoned meat could be. And there's certain breeds like Schnauzers who are prone to certain medical conditions like pancreatitis from foods that are high in fats. And those those particular dogs really shouldn't have much in the way of any kind of fat table scraps. Now, it doesn't mean that all people food is bad, as long as your pet doesn't have a sensitive digestive system. Things like carrots or small pieces of fruit, green beans, can a lot of times be acceptable supplement to their diet or a type of people food that they can have.
Are dogs basically carnivores, or are they a little more of an omnivore?
They're a little bit of an bit more of an omnivore than people typically think. A lot of people think of wolves in the wild and think, well, they're very carnivorous, and dogs are very carnivorous too. But what people don't often think about is that the dogs that we have today have been pets and bred in captivity for many, many years, and that's sort of changed them to some extent, where they're not as strict of carnivores as one might think. Cats are a little different, though. In many ways, cats are a little different, but they tend to be quite a bit more carnivorous and need a lot higher protein and some other special things in their diets that dogs don't necessarily need.
Is that important, then, to get them a properly balanced food? Because, you know, if they're out in the wild and eating, they're not just eating the meat, they're eating, you know, blood comes with and all the other things that bring them different nutrients, iron and stuff, that maybe they're not going to get in just a basic food.
Yep, that is very true. Micronutrients and vitamins that dogs and cats need. There are specific requirements for different animals. Again, cats are a little bit different. There's one particular nutrient called taurine that cats don't produce themselves, and it needs to be in their food. So a cat that would eat dog food would develop health problems from that because it doesn't have the extra supplementation of that nutrient that they need.
And they would probably also eat a lot more dog food because it doesn't have the protein they need.
Correct. They could run into problems with not high enough protein in their diets
that
as well.
And conversely, if your dog is keeping eating your cat food, he can get fat because he's getting too much protein and other things he doesn't need.
Even though he thinks it tastes better.
Well,
it's not better for him.
Okay. So you need good food, you need medical checkups. We're getting the holiday season. Are there things you need to watch out for with your pets? We always hear about chocolate, and this is a time of year when there's chocolates and all kinds of things around.
There are a few extra considerations around the holiday times. Chocolate is a good one, and that's kind of an interesting one to talk about. Milk chocolate is not so bad as some of the dark or specialty chocolates, and the worst is baking chocolate. And the toxic ingredients or toxic parts of chocolate are called theobromine and then the caffeine. And those ingredients are a lot higher concentrations in dark and baking chocolate. So whereas, if your lab were to eat a regular milk chocolate Hershey's bar, it probably wouldn't cause too many problems. But if your lab were to eat a block of baker's chocolate, that could make him very sick.
Would it taste good to the dog, or is the sugar and the milk in the milk chocolate more appetizing to it?
You'd be surprised what they'll eat that doesn't seem like it would taste good. So they definitely could eat dark chocolate, and I've seen instances when they have.
Yeah, well, I remember as a kid, Dad dropped a prune pit on the floor, and it was gone before it made the second bounce.
Yep.
Anything that hit the floor, that was fair game, I guess.
Yep, I think a lot of times they swallow it before they ever taste it. If they know it came off of the table or it's something they shouldn't have, it tastes delicious, they think.
Are there other things you need to worry about? There's things like tinsel, and
yes,
you know, these types of things
ribbons.
Are...
can be dangerous to cats. You know, they seem like great toys to the cats, but if they swallow them, sometimes they'll go through just fine, but it can be quite dangerous because if a part of that ribbon or tinsel gets stuck in the stomach and the rest sort of goes along its path in the intestines, those intestines can kind of bunch up on that long strand, and that long strand can actually cut through the intestines, and that can cause big problems. So it's a good idea to keep the tinsel and the ribbons away from the cats. Another thing to think about around this time of year are cords and strings of lights. You know, they may seem like a fun toy behind the couch or behind the Christmas tree, but that presents an electric hazard. If they chew through those wires, they could get electrocuted. So those are a couple of things. The Christmas tree itself, you know, if you've had a cat in a Christmas tree before, you probably know whether your cat's a climber. But if it's the first year you've had both, maybe you have a new kitten, something you may not think of is that may seem like a pretty appealing climbing post for that new kitten, and you should make sure your Christmas tree is secured well.
And a lot of people aren't using natural trees anymore. That's plastic.
Yep. You know, the risk of the cats chewing on the plastic in the trees and that being a toxin is not that high. Some of the decorations around your home can be sort of toxic, more of the real plants. So we always hear about poinsettias. They're not as toxic as they're made out to be. They can cause some vomiting and some diarrhea and can cause some irritation, but generally their toxicity is low. But holly berries and mistletoe can be quite toxic to pets, cats and dogs alike.
Do the holidays stress animals out? You have a lot of visitors and a lot of things going on. Is this something you need to keep in mind?
It is, and it really sort of depends on the personality of your pet. But you know, a lot of times the cats that are a little bit more reclusive and hide when they have guests. If you have a house full of guests and they're, you know, all over the house, that can be quite stressful. Providing a safe spot where they can go that's kind of quiet, maybe an upstairs bedroom or something like that where no guests will be, can sometimes minimize the anxiety for them. But that's certainly something to consider also.
And let them know where the litter box is.
Yep, let them know where the litter box is.
Because you don't want to surprise Christmas morning that you didn't know was there.
Nope. And maybe providing a little food and water in that safe spot too. So if they don't want to come out, they don't necessarily have to for that weekend.
What would you recommend to people who are visiting and there's an animal? Do you need to let the animal approach you? Because I would imagine to an animal, you're like a 60-foot giant walking up to them, and they don't know your intentions.
Yep, that's always a good rule in any situation. If there's a strange animal that you're not familiar with and you're meeting for the first time, you know, let them approach you in a non-threatening way as opposed to you going to them. You know, you'll see people extend an open hand to dogs and cats. That's actually a little bit more dangerous for you. A better thing is to, you know, extend a hand as you would, but have it in a closed fist so that they don't, if they were to bite, they're not biting your fingers.
But they can get your scent. But they can get your scent and learn that you're good.
They can see that you're not trying to threaten them. But first thing is to always ask the owner if it's okay for you to pet or approach their animal, because that's they can give you the best idea of how that will go. They know their animal's temperament pretty well. And the other thing to think of with dogs, sometimes it's kind of scary when you have your hand coming from above down on their head and they're not really sure about it. So when you're, you know, bending over and extending your hand and letting the dog come up and approach you, if they seem like they're happy and they're willing to let you touch them, a lot of times it works better to sort of touch them underneath the chin or around the side of the face and then move to petting them on the top of the head, because it's less threatening to them to have you just extending out your hand and scratching them where they can see as opposed to having your hand coming down on top of their head.
This is good for adults. With kids, do parents need to kind of counsel them before they actually get there?
Yes. That's always a good idea. You know, a dog that would otherwise be quite friendly and tolerable may, with the stress of the holidays and the commotion that's going on, suddenly there's a small child that's running at them, excited to see them and pet them, that may be just too much stress for them, and they may react in a manner that would be uncharacteristic. So that's always a good idea, even if it's a pet that maybe you've been to the house and you've met before, to kind of factor in the stresses of the holidays and give them a little extra space.
This time of year, pets sometimes get thought of as gifts. And I know you folks want to make sure they're going to a house that wants it and is ready to take care of it.
Yes, that's sometimes trouble we see. A puppy seems like a great holiday gift, and it's great on Christmas morning. But when you think of all the care and all the work that it takes raising and training that puppy, especially in our busy lives and in the wintertime when it's not necessarily fun to be outside with the dog, and it's hard to give them the exercise that they need depending on what breed you pick, it's definitely something that should be thought out and carefully considered to make sure that the family is or individual is ready for that pet, and that it's not a sort of holiday gift that's not well considered.
And would it maybe be better to put it off till after the new year, after all the visiting you're going to want to do during the holidays and that? Animals tend to acclimate better, I think, when there's some stability, some routine.
Yes, that is true. And it sort of depends on each individual situation. If you are going to be traveling a lot, you don't want to get a brand new puppy who's not used to your house and not used to you, and then tote them to a half dozen different places and a half dozen different people. You want to give them time to settle in and adjust to you, and then sort of start gradually socializing them and introducing them to new people and new places. It can be a bit overwhelming if they have to adjust to so many things at once, and it can actually sometimes set up a path for behavioral problems later.
One of the other problems we have with small pets this time of year is the cold. There's, last year was brutal. So far this year, so good. But people sometimes think it's all better to bring the animal in if it's cold. Others have said, then they get used to the warmth and then they're colder when they go back out. What is the good rule on this?
The good rule is that if you have an outside animal and it's cold and you want to bring them in to sort of room temperature the way we would heat our houses, that's going to be a difficult transition if you're planning on putting them back outside at some point. That's not really an ideal way to provide a little extra warmth for them. Providing bedding that would be warm, providing a shelter that would block the wind that their body heat would help to warm, or providing some external heat source. It really depends on what types of animals we're talking about in the space, but different types of heaters or heat lamps can sometimes be a way to do that, to sort of increase the ambient temperature of their shelter, but not really bring them up to 65 or 70 degrees that we would have in a house, unless you plan to keep them there for the rest of the winter. For inside animals, we want to be careful not to leave them outside too long, especially our small pets. Frostbite in winters like we had last year can happen quite quickly. They are not really acclimated, and we think of some of our smaller breeds, they're not really designed anymore to be outside and handling those cold weathers. So a lot of times it's best to provide them an opportunity to go outside, go to the bathroom, and then come right back in. And don't forget, if the snow is as tall as your small dog or cat and you want to let them outside, you'll probably have to shovel an area for them.
Okay. If you have a shelter outside for the animal, Do people often sometimes think they're being nice by making it large and roomy when in fact it needs to be just the right size so they can heat it with their body?
Yep, that's correct. So providing insulation on the outsides of the shelter, providing deep bedding within the shelter, and making it small enough that they can, you know, comfortably lay in it, but not that it's so large that they can't heat the air with their body. So you know, you think of some of the smaller dog houses and things, or a little bit larger area for sheep and goats. You know, they kind of need that small space to create warmth on their own.
And do they need it raised up off the ground a little bit? The ground conducts a lot of heat away.
It depends on the situation. For a dog house, that can make sense. For you know, it doesn't always become a practical thing for some of our livestock. So you can provide a lot of insulation against that ground with you know, good deep bedding of straw, wood chips, different substrates like that.
Now, when you get into the winter, people think there's snow out there, so they're not all that concerned about a water dish. But the animals need more water in the winter, don't they?
They do. You know, they eating snow will only lead to dehydration, and also will make them colder. So access to fresh water is very important. Another thing to think about as we're talking about winter time and pets outdoors is a lot of the salts and ice melt products that we use can be quite irritating to the feet of the animals, and if they ingest enough of it, some of it can even be toxic. So making sure that when they go outside and they come in, if you're using ice melt products, that you clean off their feet well, so that they're not licking it off themselves, causing sores on their feet, possibly in their mouths, or maybe even issues of a toxicity.
And we always hear about antifreeze and that. That's also a highly toxic thing.
Yes, very toxic. A good thing for people to remember is, you know, they hear antifreeze is toxic, but they don't really understand what that looks like. For our cats and dogs, if they ingest antifreeze, immediately following, they'll almost act drunk, so they will have incoordination and stumbling. And then that subsides, but that's really when the real damage occurs. Within usually 48 hours time, they can go into acute kidney failure from that. And that doesn't become an apparent problem until days later. But by days later, there's it's quite a struggle to save them with that, whereas if we know that it's occurred and can intervene right away, we can do a lot to help.
Okay. And cats also have a wonderful habit of crawling into a warm engine compartment.
Yes. That's that's another thing to watch for is, you know, an old rule we would do around our house when we had some outside cats was we'd beep the horn once or twice before we started the engine. To see if we could scare a cat out. But that's definitely something to be concerned about. There's been many cats who have gotten injured by fan belts.
And we've been talking about these types of things, but what about spaying and neutering? Does that prolong the life of an animal on average, or is it a misnomer?
It does prolong the life of an animal, and the timing of the spaying and neutering can be pretty important, too. So in female dogs, it's been studied that they'll have a very significant reduction in the incidence of cancerous mammary tumors if you spay them before their first heat cycle. And that benefit decreases by a few percentage points all the way until they're 2 years old. So there's benefit to preventing cancer later in life for them, up until the point they're 2 years old, if you get them spayed before they're two. And you get the most benefit if you spay them around 6 months old, before their first heat cycle, which in most dogs occurs between 6 and 8 months of age. For other health-related issues, they can get uterine infections. They get it. Big infected reproductive tract, and we call that a pyometra, and that can be a life-threatening disease for older female dogs that are intact. And they can get tumors of their ovaries as well. So those are all reasons to spay a female dog. Male dogs, it's not quite as well established the ideal time to neuter a dog. We know that it's good to do it after they're 6 months old, and we know that it's good to do probably before they're 2 years old. But depending on the breed and your intended use for that dog, we can advise you a little bit on when is the ideal time to neuter in your particular case. But neutering the dog prevents some unwanted behaviors, leg lifting and marking territory and wanting to run around. And it can also help for preventing testicular cancers and also prevent prostate problems later on in the dog's life.
Any studies as to whether it has any effect on their personality, psychology? Do they benefit from not becoming a full adult and learning all of those traits and retain some puppy or kitten in them?
Well, it is well understood that male dogs, as they become more mature and they have more dominance behaviors, that sometimes those dominance behaviors can lead to an unruly dog or even aggression towards people. That's one of those things that seems to happen a little later on. So, by the time they're year and a half, 2 years old, that's when we start to see manifestations of those. Letting them fully mature as far as bone development and size of their frame and weight won't necessarily lead to those negative behaviors. So that's why, depending on different breeds have different growth rates. Depending on your intended use, if you have a show dog or a family pet, can depend on when is best to neuter a dog.
What about physical modifications to an animal? And I'm turning them into almost like the dog Kardashian. You bob tails, you trim ears, you declaw cats. What is the benefit? Is it all aesthetics?
No, it's certainly not all aesthetics, but sometimes it purely is. And what we see a lot of times is, originally it wasn't aesthetics because of what the animal's intended use was. And since a lot of those pets are not used for that these days, it has become something aesthetic. An example is a Jack Russell Terrier. It's a small terrier dog. They're very tenacious. They used to be used to hunt different types of rodents and things that lived in the ground in holes, and they would dock their tail so that it didn't become an impedance to them when they would actually go down in these rodent holes. But they would leave the tail long enough that it was about 5 inches long or 4 inches long, about the length of your hand, so you could retrieve your dog from the hole by its tail. This is something that very few Jack Russells ever experience, but it's breed standard that they have their tail docked, and so we still will do that. Another more modern-day example is herding dogs. Australian Shepherds breed standards call for them to have a docked tail, and they have a rather long coat. And if they're out in the field and their job is to guard and herd livestock, that long tail with its long fur can be quite a problem as far as just getting debris and dirt in the tail, and also getting in the way of what they're doing. So that was the original reason for their tails to be docked. And in a true working dog, that there's still a good justification for that. But for most house pets, it's not something that's necessary for their healthy lives, but it is something that is sort of a part of their identity as that breed.
Declawing, I know there are states that are trying to outlaw it.
That's one of those things that's controversial. It's really not a nice surgery. It's when we're declawing the cats, we're not just removing the claws, because the claws grow from the very first digit. So we're actually removing that first digit. So it's kind of removing the tips of their fingers, if we were to, you know, make an analogy to people. And it's, you know, we clean things as well as we can, but it's hard to get around the nail and the nail itself completely sterile the way we do when we do spays and neuters. So there's always that potential for introducing bacteria, though. In real life, infection rates are quite low. But, you know, if we consider the alternative and consider some situations where it might be a cat who belongs to, you know, an older person who's on blood thinners, and the cat may accidentally scratch them, and that could cause serious health problems or dangers to the owner. So those are situations when, you know, it's a modification that we can make, and we can control pain and infection and have a good outcome with minimal discomfort and complication to the animal, and still allow that person to have that pet that otherwise it would be a danger for them. So there are certainly some situations when it's warranted. I usually try to make sure that people are very aware of what they're asking for when they ask for that procedure, and try to make sure that it's necessary for their pets with in their lives.
Okay. People getting a pet, thoroughbred or the Heinz 57 variety, which generally seem to be the stronger? Is it because they're so inbred, the thoroughbreds, that sometimes they get hip dysplasia and these other types of problems?
Well, I guess there's a concept called hybrid vigor. So there's the more things you cross into an individual, the better they seem to be able to deal with a lot of things. So I think that there is no healthier pet than a mutt. That being said, if you want specific traits or specific personality, you know you can get that in purebred dogs. It's another one of those things where there's lots of animals in shelters, and if you find a mutt in a shelter and it seems like that will fit your family's needs or your individual needs for a pet, then I think that will be a great pet for someone. But if they know that maybe they have young kids, or maybe they're having a dog that's going to be spending a lot of time outside, they can select certain breeds that have characteristics that will fit best in their situation. And you can kind of know what you're getting into, or at least have a better chance of knowing what you're getting into when you get a specific breed.
All cats and dogs shed. People, that's one of the things people, you know, don't like, is the shedding. But we shed, so I imagine dogs and cats.
All cats and dogs shed to some extent. You know, there are some dogs that have fur that's more like hair, and then it continues to grow. They don't necessarily have as prominent a season of shedding. But like you said, even people shed. All dogs shed. And I know there are lots of talk of hypoallergenic dogs. Can't really have a hypoallergenic dog, because a lot of what some people are allergic to is the dandruff that dogs produce. And even if a dog has no hair, they still produce dandruff on their skin as their skin continues to replace itself and the dead top layer of the skin falls off. So there are dogs that I would say are less allergenic than others, but there's no such thing as a completely non-allergenic, hypoallergenic dog.
All right. Well, I appreciate you taking time with us today. We're getting a little short on our time. Is there anything else people need to know with the winter season here about their animals?
No, I think we've pretty much covered it. The one thing to think about, again, for outside animals is they're going to burn a lot more energy outside staying warm. So, your outside pets need to have more food than they would in the summertime. So that's it's good to make sure that they're in a good body condition going into wintertime. We think of our horses and things like that. So if they are, not in great body condition, that's a good time to check teeth and check for parasites, make sure that, they're not competing with some intestinal worms for their nutrients and things like blankets and extra things to help them stay warm become more important so they can use their calories more efficiently.
Should they have food always on demand? Or because you can do that with dry for the most part unless you have other critters coming and eating it. But, the canned food, that gets kind of nasty after a while.
Yeah. Most outside cats and dogs and things, sometimes you can get into obesity issues with them. And sometimes it's not practical. Raccoons and possums really like dog food too, and you don't want to necessarily bring them into your animal's enclosures. But if it's practical and they don't have trouble with obesity, providing food for them all the time is fine. But the main idea is they're going to need more than they do in the summer. So make sure that you're accounting for that when you're figuring out how much food you're giving them.
Well, again, I appreciate you taking time today. If people have more questions, these are the things to ask your vet when you go to a visit.
Yep, and thank you very much for your time, and it was very nice talking to you.
And your middle name with the hyphen, it's Brandon.
It's actually Brandon's my first name, and Heido Fernandez is my last name, which Heido is Fernandez. Quite the mouthful. So if you want to come ask more questions, you can find me here at Bad Axe Animal Clinic and just ask for Dr. Brandon.
All right. Thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you. Goodbye.
We've been talking with Dr. Brandon Heido Fernandez from the Small Animal Clinic, Bad Axe Animal Clinic. And if you do have questions on your pets, talk to your doctor. He or she will be able to pass along the information you need. Coming up at the top of the hour, we will clue you in on all the latest in the news. Keep it here at WLEW.
Out of me, I know heaven's gotta be this kind of town.